Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Let's discuss kids and drugs, this time in a way that's never happened before. A meth lab discovered inside a building in one of America's Big Ten schools, Michigan State University. Here's WWJ in Detroit.
Michigan State University police announced that 31-year-old Shin Tong was arrested for allegedly running a meth lab in Wells Hall on campus. It's MSU's biggest academic facility and was evacuated Monday after an unidentified chemical substance was found. Police actually ran into Tong at Wells Hall on Sunday, where they found bags full of legal substances. MSU Police Chief Mike Yankowski said the FBI was called in after that.
We wanted to ensure that the substances weren't explosives. So I think it's important to state that the substances that we found were all what you would refer to as common products that can be purchased in retail stores, online. They were not explosive. And so that's why we brought in our federal partners until we could understand what we had.
Wells Hall will remain closed through tomorrow. Officials are cleaning and making sure it's safe to occupy again. Parts of the building were damaged. They say those repairs could cost over $20,000. MSU officials say they could not say if Tong was a student or faculty member due to student privacy laws.
From meth, let's discuss marijuana gummies and the growing trend of kids getting their hands on them. Here's WWJ.
You've got a case where you had six kids eating marijuana gummies at an elementary school, and are you seeing a rise in cases of kids eating gummies like this?
Yeah, it's certainly concerning. I can tell you that it is not uncommon. To get six patients at one time is uncommon, but on a daily basis, we have patients who present to our emergency department after eating marijuana gummies or food that contains marijuana. Commonly, we'll see children between 1 and 3 who think it's candy. They pick it up and eat it, and then they're brought in because they're behaving differently.
You kind of anticipated my next question. How does ingesting these gummies affect the kids? What physical symptoms do they show?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really depends on the potency of the gummy or whatever they're ingesting, and the size of the child. So the smaller the child is, the bigger dose they're going to essentially get. So the little kids present and they're unresponsive, basically. They have altered mental status. They're not responding well. And if it's a massive ingestion, they're at risk for cardiac arrhythmias.
What are the parents' reactions that the child got into the gummies? Do they seem upset? I mean, what's the reaction?
Yeah, sure. I think the reactions are varied because some know that what happened. Sometimes they had a party. Sometimes these items are left out. Sometimes they see their child ingest it and they're really worried, so they bring their child in right away. But others are certainly surprised and upset, sure.
What's your advice for parents who want to have the gummies? They want to ingest the gummies for themselves, but what's your advice for parents to keep those gummies out of children's hands?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It is all about safe storage. So leaving these items in the child protective packaging that they come in, and also storing them out of reach of a child.
Let me wrap it up with this then. Anything you want to add to this interview that we didn't touch on, or anything you want to expand on that we did?
Hey, you know, one thing is this is a nationwide trend, and we've seen an increased incidence of this over the past few years, ever since, you know, each state's different with the legalization, but it's been legal here now for a shorter period of time than some other states. But we definitely have seen a spike in, you know, accidental ingestions since legalization.
More young children are ingesting pot gummies because they think they're candy, and that's illegal. Obviously. But the laws around marijuana are changing. Here's KCBS in San Francisco with the latest.
This is a pretty big deal, right? Moving state-licensed medical marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3?
It is historic. Since 1970, cannabis has sat at the top of the federal government's list of dangerous drugs. Schedule 1, equivalent to PCP or heroin. And just for some context, Schedule fentanyl, which has been killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, sits at Schedule 2. So this is a historic error that the Trump administration is fixing with this final order today.
Yeah, this is, the fact that marijuana has been Schedule 1, I mean, that almost seems like reefer madness lives on, right?
Very much so. That's the exact word to use. In the 1940s, the American Medical Association said, hey, this drug has benefits. They're using it for migraines, pain, epilepsy, a bunch of mood disorders. And the AMA lost that round in the 1940s. In 1996, California voters went to the polls and said, hey, this is medicine. It's good for cancer. It's good for HIV. It's good for a number of things. And they approved medical marijuana in 1996. The federal government went after state licensed physicians and raided stores. Here we are in 2026. And now the federal government is affirmatively saying they were right all along. We've been gaslighting you. This is medicine.
I want to look at some of the nuts and bolts of this. But first, a lot of presidents before didn't do this. Can we read anything into Donald Trump's decision, his acting AG, to make this move?
Yeah, this is the executive branch executing. 83% of Americans support medical marijuana. You can't get 83% of Americans to support anything, like even clean water. And yet Congress did nothing. President Biden tried to do this through the normal processing channels, and it didn't work. Instead, it took a real bull in a china shop like President Trump to order his attorney general to just do it, like wave the wand and do a final order, quote, without regard to the rulemaking process. It was very non-traditional, and it's very in keeping with this administration and, frankly, voters who are fed up with Congress that does nothing.
It's been interesting that if you have two states that are neighboring states, and I'll just say, let's say California and Oregon, that both have legal marijuana, yet you take marijuana from California into Oregon or vice versa, it is a pretty serious federal crime. Will this change that?
Not necessarily, but you have to look at the real politic of enforcement priorities and resources. The federal government on the drug enforcement angle is obsessed with the fentanyl coming over the border, our opioid deaths. Cannabis is really not on their radar. And frankly, it's never been on their radar unless you're a heavy duty trafficker. And then at the state level, same thing. They have limited budgets. They have big priorities. You can't even get a jury to convict people for cannabis crimes anymore. So yeah, on the recreational side, on the movement around the cannabis side, there will still be criminal penalties involved. It's just a matter of where and when they're enforced, and we're not seeing that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention enforcement. I mean, do we ever hear about people who, say, buy a bag of weed in California and take it to their cousin's house in Oregon? I mean, are those people being arrested and thrown in jail?
No, we're at a historic low for prosecution of small-time pot offenses. California used to do it to the tune of 100,000 people a year, 100,000 life courses altered by a simple possession ticket that could mess up your financial aid, your housing, your job. That's not happening anymore. Now we see some enforcement around really big mega grows, sometimes cartel affiliated, and ones that are in national forests, state forests. They're using pesticides out there. We care more about that mega trafficking and that environmental damage.
So what does moving cannabis from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 actually change for users, patients, doctors, researchers? What does it do?
Medical marijuana is back. So there are tax breaks for patients who have a medical card. We only have about 1,000 to 2,000 medical patients left in California. And now there's going to be tax breaks for medical only producers. You think of states like Oklahoma and District of Columbia that have medical only program. Those producers just got a tax break. I'm counting maybe a couple hundred medical only licensees in California left. But I bet that's about to be a really big new growth sector. Medical is very much back on the tax break side.
Are there doctors who have perhaps been reluctant to prescribe medicinal marijuana to their patients for fear of it being a Schedule 1 drug?
1,000%. This is going to end the federal monopoly on research marijuana. So doctors and researchers who want to study the plant can actually get supplies of stuff that people are using in these states. It's going to waterfall down into places like Kaiser, which won't prescribe you medications or do a surgery if they find that you're using cannabis. Because again, in their gimlet eye, they have to think, hey, this person's using pot. It's the same thing as PCP or heroin. That's not the case anymore. We really won't even begin to see the consequences of untying this historic Gordian knot that they buried cannabis under for so long.
Critics say that this move benefits the cannabis industry. Is this a public health decision, or is this an economic decision, or maybe a little of both?
It's very much a public health decision. Cannabis has been saving lives for decades now, and it is an economic decision. It's a $60 billion U.S. industry. Some of those industry members have the ear of people in the executive branch. We could potentially export medical cannabis to the rest of the world and really help. You know, our farmers and help patients all over the world. There's, you know, it's always a little bit of both. And I think that's the case here.
KCBS listener Matt has sent in a question. Are there significant impacts to states where it is already legalized?
It remains to be seen. This has more questions than answers, and we're going to have to see what happens. You can bet that opponents of this are going to sue. They're supposed to have a hearing starting on June 29th, although it's unclear what they're going to be hearing since the acting AG just put out a final order. What this is like an incremental step forward that changes the playing field and opens up new avenues and opportunities. Day to day here in California, it's going to make people focus more on the medical side for the tax breaks.
You say that there are critics and opponents lining up to perhaps try to block this. Who are these critics and opponents? Who is it that opposes legal medical marijuana?
I would call them moral entrepreneurs. Since the dawn of time, you'll have people who say, hey, society would be better if this drug wasn't in the picture. And then there is the legacy drug war establishment that was profiting from cannabis arrests, cannabis seizures, property seizures, property forfeiture. They'll take your car, take your house. And now you've got the sheriff driving around in a Bentley. That's in places like Texas. So where there's money, you're going to have trouble convincing people to change their ways.
Order signed by the president's acting attorney general has reclassified state licensed drugs, shifting licensed medical marijuana from a Schedule I drug to a Schedule III drug. We are talking about that with David Downs, San Francisco cannabis journalist and author. How might this reclassification impact cannabis businesses?
They're going to be taking a close look at their dual-use license, and it's unclear. So most licensees in California are dual-use adult and medical, and that medical component is a vestige of the Prop 215 days. But I think they're going to be taking another look at it because that's where there's tax savings. Currently, right now, if you're a retailer, you're looking at an 80% tax burden because you can't deduct normal and necessary business expenses under IRS Section 280E. This order says that that part of the IRS tax code, this penalty, will no longer apply to medical-only businesses because this is a Schedule III drug instead of a Schedule I drug. It takes the pressure off the throat of medical cannabis businesses, and I do expect to see businesses taking advantage of that. And another thing it says is to ask the IRS to make these tax savings retroactive. So if you've been in the medical business under this burden for a number of years, you might be getting a big tax refund.
Okay, so I want to clarify here that this is for medical marijuana. You know, what about the guy who just has a baggie of pot? Does this change anything there at all?
Cannabis remains Schedule I for non-medical uses. At the state level, at the federal level. In the state, we did legalize up to an ounce walking around, several grams of hash, and a bunch of edibles.
Okay, so there is a very clear delineation then between medical and recreational, right?
Correct, at this time, yes.
Okay, I wonder, as you look at this, with the administration fast-tracking broader changes, could this be a stepping stone toward full federal legalization of marijuana?
It's very much an incremental gain, and it changes the footing underneath which the states and the feds operate. So you're already hearing lawmakers say, that's great. What are we doing about the people still getting arrested for cannabis? What are we doing about patients or employers or students who are being penalized for use that's lawful in a number one of these states? It's going to increase the clamor for more change on more fronts. And that's the way the federal government works, inch by inch, very slowly, very deliberately. And in this case, it took 60 years.
I don't know if there are many people out there who have a record because of having what has been illegal medicinal marijuana, but could this be retroactive? I mean, is there a chance that some of those people could get their records expunged?
We've seen expungement efforts since legalization has advanced, and the governor of California touted that at 10 years into legalization in California, they've expunged hundreds of thousands of records. This was spreading across the country, state by state, and up to the federal level. It's a very slow process to unwind all the damage done from the war on marijuana, but this is another tailwind to those efforts.
What does this mean for taxes and tax revenues?
I think overall, the amount of taxes that the cannabis business is paying into state and federal coffers is a drop in the bucket. So you shouldn't expect some major reduction in revenue at the state or federal level. But if you're one of these cannabis businesses that's laboring under the worst taxation environment you could have for any type of product, it's going to be a breath of fresh air. Woody Harrelson's got a store in LA, and he was sitting down with Bill Maher talking about how guns are taxed at 10% and beer is taxed at 30%. And his pot in his store is taxed at 35% at the LA level. And then you got to add on the federal tax deductions that bring it up to 80%. That's why prices are so high for consumers. That's why we're having such a hard time getting consumers to come into the legal market in California. About half of the market in California 10 years in remains on the illegal side.
Bipartisan disagreement still strong in Congress. Is there any realistic path toward a unified federal marijuana policy after this move?
I think they're going to keep chipping away at the edges of it. Both parties have wins they can notch by working together. It's obviously very tough for them with partisan gridlock in Congress. They can barely pass a budget at any time. But this is a bellwether. If something's like 80% in favor and the executive branch is doing it, I think it gives more cover for not only Democrats, but Republicans to advance policies that people support.
Kai says, I've heard that business owners can't use regular banks. Would this policy change and let them use a normal bank? It says, I understand this is one reason why they are frequently robbed. Yeah, a lot of cash on hand, perhaps.
Bringing up another good point. I think if you're a medical business and you're operating under Schedule 3 instead of Schedule 1, banks are going to go easier on you. Of course, the banking system is really conservative and they're going to move really slow. But I would expect moving this to Schedule 3, taking Schedule 1 out of the picture, is going to ease the banking situation, at least for medical operators in the nearer term and potentially other operators in the longer term, and help with those security issues with cash.
In Washington, are there still opponents of any marijuana legalization, and how does the Trump administration's move here kind of fit in with that?
Sure. Especially on the far right flank of the Republicans, you're going to have people that are ready to go back to full prohibition. But that ship has sailed. They're a minority voice, even in the Republican Party. You look at a state like Florida, which is Trump's home base. They have big medical cannabis industry that has Trump's ear. And I think they speak with a louder voice, especially financially, than the hyper-religious, hyper-conservative branch that would like to turn the clock back to 1960. But frankly, in a functional democracy, Congress would have tackled this in the 90s.
Let's move on to smoke of another kind. Wildfire smoke, which may blanket the skies of the upper Midwest and the coasts this summer. Here's WCCO in Minneapolis.
Frustrated Minnesotans often ask why Canada just lets its fires burn. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency meteorologist Matt Tarleton says it's because there's typically no threat to lives or property since they're often in remote, unpopulated areas.
There's no easy way to get people in there. If you put people out in the middle of nowhere to fight these fires, they cannot come back to, you know, a city or something to fight a fire that would start and would threaten life and property. So that's a big part of the problem.
Tarleton adds Canada often has hundreds of remote wildfires burning at the same time. And while smoke will likely drift into Minnesota again this summer, we shouldn't have as many air quality alert days as last year, one of the worst years for smoke in recent memory.
Here's more on wildfires from KCBS.
You know that wildfires are no longer seasonal, and across the U.S. we have seen more than 200 lives lost and $45 billion worth of property damaged or destroyed. So to encourage risk reduction, the National Fire Protection Association is declaring May 2nd as Wildfire Community Preparedness Day. For a closer look at this, we turn to the KCBS Ring Central Newsline to speak with Michelle Steinberg, director of the Wildfire Division, at the association. And Michelle, we hear about this in California every year at this time, but you can't repeat it enough. What should people be doing as we head into, I guess, the traditional wildfire season? And again, bearing in mind, it's no longer just seasonal.
Yes, that's very important to remember. It's no longer seasonal, but there are things people can do to protect their homes. And we ask people to get together on Wildfire Community Preparedness Day or any day that's convenient for them, to start to prepare their homes and prepare their neighbors. And so there are many things that people can do, starting with taking a look around their home for potential ignition sources, clearing those away, fixing things that might allow embers to enter the home, and working with neighbors to reduce shared risks.
We hear about all the time defensible space, and it's, I think the guidelines may have maybe changing on that or fluid a little bit on how much defensible space do you need? And first of all, what is defensible space?
Sure. Defensible space, or, taking care of your home ignition zone, is very important. And what the experience of fires and the science is showing us is the work you do to your home and then working out from your home, starting with the first 5 feet from your home, is really critical. It's where embers can blow in. For example, if you notice wind blowing debris into certain corners or roof lines, that's exactly where that debris collects, is exactly where the embers will go. So that's why it's so important to get rid of any of that material that could cause a problem during a fire. And then it's generalized to out to about 100 feet, but that really depends on how much room you have. And that's why it's important, if you have a neighbor closer than that, to work with a neighbor to reduce the risks at their property, because you will affect each other.
We are seeing right now wildfires in the southeast, in Georgia, places that you don't often associate with wildfires. And clearly it's going to be, again, the traditional fire season coming up very soon in the Bay Area. Are there areas that are at risk that maybe weren't in the past, or just things to think about if you think that you're at a place that's safe from wildfires, maybe think again?
Sure. And really what we find is across North America, very many ecosystems, most ecosystems depend on fire and have fire as part of the landscape. It's just that we often suppress the fires that nature is throwing our way. So what we're seeing, unfortunately, in Georgia right now, there's a lot of the vegetative fuel that's grown up. They're having a particularly hot, dry, drought-stricken season. And any ignition now with these conditions can really cause problems. And that's what we're seeing happen. So I think if people realize, oh, there's very overgrown woods or lands near me, we see a lot of that material. It's hot, dry. We've been in extended drought. That's not just about water supply. That's going to stress the trees and the vegetation to where they're much more vulnerable should a fire ignite.
What are some of the things that you should have in your house when you're thinking about wildfires? And I'm talking about, you know, the go bag, but also fire extinguishers. I mean, what are some of the things that people should be thinking about having on hand as they become more aware about the risk from wildfires?
Sure. Well, I think those sort of long-term preparedness is really gardening tools, getting out there, doing some fixes to the home, perhaps doing some retrofits and upgrades to the outside of your property. But inside, you want to make sure that any doors, openings, vents, screens can be sealed. Some of that could be permanent. Some of that could be temporary if you are having fire weather that you're concerned about. But really, what we mostly recommend if there is a fire threatening is that people do evacuate to somewhere safer. That's very important. And having that go bag, the things that you will need to make you comfortable and keep you safe for the next 24 to 78 hours, is pretty critical.
Michelle Steinberg is the director of the Wildfire Division at the National Fire Protection Association, reminding us about National Wildfire Community Preparedness Day next Saturday. But really, preparedness should be a year-round thing.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.